everybody, and welcome to another episode of Reverb. My name is Alex Helberg, and I'm joined on the mic by my co-host and co-executive producer, Calvin Pollock. How you doing, Calvin?
Doing great, Alex. How about you?
I'm doing great. Just boiling in my skin here in Connecticut on the East Coast.
What's the temp there right now?
Right now, so we're actually in kind of a cool lull today. It is a brisk 82 degrees outside. Yesterday and the day before, we were reaching up into the mid-90s a couple days before that. And for the last couple weeks, we've been dipping into the hundreds, you know, because that's what a crisp New England summer is supposed to be all about, right? Probably totally normal and nothing to worry about. How are things out on the West Coast, Calvin?
Well, in the Pacific Northwest, it's a very mild, you know, mid to upper 60s here in Seattle. It's lovely, honestly. It was hot last weekend, and honestly, I had COVID over July 4th weekend,
oh,
which sucked.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was a bummer, but, you know.
So you couldn't go see fireworks?
I couldn't celebrate our great country, and that's the part that gets me, is that I wanted to support our dear leader, Mr. Trump, and this great country that he's making better and better by day. Actually, I wanted to bring this up. You know, Alex, I know that the weather is rough this summer, but, you know, if terrifyingly some kind of natural disaster occurs or anything, at least you'll get a lot of support from the federal government. We're just adding more and more programs and supports.
That's right.
And if you need healthcare, you'll be able to get it.
Yeah.
Everything is on the up and up in
That's
terms
right.
of government support.
Oh, I know. I'm so grateful for that, especially with the, OBBBA. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act is the official title. It's ABBA, not to be confused with the Swedish pop group. ABBA is the official name of the bill.
If anyone's the dancing queen here, it's Mr. Trump. I've seen him dance.
Yeah, it was disheartening to see the ABBA pass and then only several days later have disastrous flooding in Texas and New Mexico that was
horrible.
Hampered almost unequivocally, unarguably by the firing of federal administrative workers, as well as the declaration that all emergency federal funds needed to go through Kristi Noem's office and get signed off on by her office before being dispersed, that almost certainly contributed to the delay in funds and resources going to those communities. But then also seeing that apparently there is a White House faith office now. I don't know if that's a thing that existed before the Trump administration, but they've literally institutionalized thoughts and prayers now as like an official government office, which just feels like the most auspicious and maybe terrifying part of all of this is that we've sacrificed actual administrative resources for an office of thoughts and prayers. And that is to me just, I mean, it's perfectly indicative of kind of the general can't-do attitude of this presidential administration.
Yeah, and I just want to, I mean, just picking up from our last episode, the fact that there's now a White House thoughts and prayers office, like, I wonder if this will cause any of the people who, you know, love to orientalize the Iranian government to think about maybe there, we do have a little bit of religion going on in our government here,
just
too.
The smallest
sliver of a lack of separation between church and state. I mean, that is just like, I don't know what to do with that.
No, I mean, again, it's one of those things where I think, you know, they wear the irony of it on their sleeves so much, and they just sort of say, yeah, well, what are you going to do about it? I mean, the answer is probably going to come in the form of electoral, basically, I mean, hopefully just absolute decimation at the ballot box in a couple of years. But I mean, also, yeah, well, whatever. I don't put my faith in any of that. I don't predict the future. We're beyond that at this point. We're rhetorical analysts. We can only look backwards.
That's right.
We need to stay in our lane here. So anyway.
What is our lane, Alex?
What is our lane? Our lane, you know, is one of, we don't live life in the fast lane, as the song goes. We are kind of slowing things down. We're taking a little bit more of a critical look at some of the rhetoric that is out in the public sphere. That is our lane. We are in the traveling lane.
I'm glad you say that, because my partner and I, Elena and I, we were walking down the street yesterday, and Elena knew that we were recording this today, and we're kind of like on a quiet street where, you know, people in the houses nearby, or, you know, people in their yards, or, others around could have heard us talking. And she referred to, like, I'm glad you're recording tomorrow or something like that. She didn't want to say podcast because we're living in a very incendiary time for podcasts, right? So, like, it's almost kind of like an admission of guilt to say
Oh,
that you
yeah.
have a podcast or you're
Oh, yeah.
involved in podcasting.
It's
Like
the
you're,
last thing I tell people about myself.
I know, like you're scamming someone or you're, so
Yeah.
yeah, I was just sort of like imagining someone hearing her use the word podcast and just screaming from their house, like, is it a pro-Trump podcast or an anti-Trump podcast? And me just saying, actually, it's a pro-rhetoric podcast. We
Yes.
support rhetoric and rhetorical thought and rhetorical analysis. That's what we
Have
do
you,
here.
madam, have you ever heard of Isocrates? Can we start
Yeah.
from a position of, let's take things back a little
We're
bit.
talking gorgeous.
We're talking Gorgias. We're talking Protagoras. We're talking all the famous pre-Socratics that
And
were,
post-Socratics.
and
We got
post.
Cicero. We got
Yeah. We've got to,
Quintilian
yeah,
going.
absolutely. No, we've
Your
got them all.
quintiles measured up.
That's right. Well, you spoke about scams earlier, Calvin,
That's
and
right.
we're talking about a rather large scam today. No, I don't
That's
want to
true.
frame it totally that way, but yeah, we're talking about AI in government today because it's something that's been on our radar for a little while here. AI is obviously something that, as teachers of writing and communication, we are kind of intimately concerned with, if not, kind of reorienting our scholarship around. You and I both have some background in corpus linguistics and corpus rhetorical analysis. Obviously, went to Carnegie Mellon. I sat in on many a natural language processing talk while I was there. I had colleagues over in computer science who knew things about this. And so, it kind of was interesting. And again, I want to use the word kind of auspicious that, when consumer large language models, specifically that form of AI, started to kind of profuse into the discourse, public discourse, as well as into academia, we were kind of, in this position where we're like, okay, yeah, I think we can do a little bit of myth busting about this. We can help people talk and think a little bit more sensibly about what these technologies are, what they aren't, what they can do, what they can't do. And moreover, just trying to think a little bit more realistically about how to integrate them into our work lives or not in cases where they might not be useful. We're now dealing with a new sort of zeitgeist where AI has been proliferating in the spheres of government in ways that are both stated and maybe not so well stated. So, I mean, I guess it's first probably good to get our priors out on the table here. So, Calvin, where are you currently at? As a scholar and a teacher of writing, professional and technical communication, where do you stand on the use of AI and specifically in some of the more sort of like technical or professional environments where you are, training the future communicators of our country?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm really glad that you framed this around the current administration because I think it heightens the significance of this challenge for writing instructors and scholars of writing. I mean, we're really kind of experiencing the first totally post AI presidency. And I would say it's like the first presidency that seems to have fully embraced the dumbest, most unreflective, uncritical approach to both thinking about and using AI in communication and research and analysis. And I think the biggest thing that I emphasize to my students and that I try to emphasize in my scholarship is whatever the exact opposite of this is. I mean, it's almost kind of like that Seinfeld episode, I Will Do the Opposite, where George basically realizes that every instinct he has is wrong. And so therefore, if he were to do the opposite, his actions would be correct, right?
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Yes, I will do the opposite.
And that's kind of like, I like to hold up these examples, both in my classes and in my research, where we can see AI going so left, like so brutally wrong, that it kind of illustrates everything that we're trying to do right in our communication and in our research on a regular basis. So one of the things that I emphasize a lot is actually being curious about what these models do and what the kind of text they output actually looks like as a rhetorical artifact, because fundamentally, you know, these tools are rhetorical both in how they're presented to us, like they try to persuade us to use them in certain ways, but they're also rhetorical in their makeup. Like they have a limited training data set. They have particular aspects of their text generation models that produce a rhetoric, right? That have a certain rhetoric that prefers certain kinds of structures. So our former colleague, our producer emeritus, Mike Laudenbach, formerly of Carnegie Mellon, now at New Jersey Institute of Technology, came and gave a talk here at UW about some of the work that he's been doing in his research group comparing human-generated and AI-generated writing. And the work is just so rich because we can kind of see a lot of the mistakes that we often correct our students' writing, or the sort of like entry-level, overly dense writing style that we see in both in student writing and in a lot of technical writing, is being outputted by these models. And so it becomes an opportunity to reinforce a lot of the rhetorical skills and principles of good style that we've long kind of embraced in writing studies. So I like to kind of look at it as this repository of bad writing and bad rhetoric, both in the sense of like, you can very easily get it to output hallucinations, right? Like factual errors. And then you can kind of laugh about those and correct them and sort of reinforce, you know, what your community of learning, either in your classroom or in your discipline, in your workplace, kind of already knows. So it becomes a way of like sanity checking ourselves to say, we actually know a lot. We know a lot more than this tool, and we can point out its errors. So yeah, you can use it as an opportunity to generate a lot of bad rhetoric, but it can also be this really interesting sort of larger social controversy, which is what we're seeing with the current administration. Like, we can look at these case studies of how the current administration is using it uncritically and corruptly in a lot of cases. And we can also look at lots of the really bad journalistic reporting about it that falls for very obvious hype claims by AI companies like OpenAI and Google and Microsoft without critically scrutinizing them. And so that's a lot of the kind of work that Emily Bender does on her podcast and other sort of critical AI scholars do.
Yeah. And in her upcoming, or maybe it's already out, book with Alex Hanna, I think it's Decoding the Rhetoric of AI Hype. We'll get the name right and we'll put the citation in the work as well. Former guest on Reverb, Emily Bender.
Shouts out. And my colleague at UW. I reference her work all the time, both with students and to other scholars. But yeah, I guess just to kind of bring it home, I would say my overall philosophy on AI is just kind of like curiosity about it. Like, I am genuinely not in a way that I'm like Pollyanna-ish about it or positive towards it. I'm very much neutral towards it, but I'm curious about it as a rhetorical, political, social, economic phenomenon, and even a user experience phenomenon. So that's the reason that I don't ban my students from using it, and that we often experiment with it as collective class units, is that I want us to understand how the actual tool is designed and the ways in which those design choices are rhetorical choices too. There's just so much to unpack as a rhetorical phenomenon. And I think it's kind of like, it's relevant to so many different things I teach, whether it's technical writing or political theory or surveillance studies. AI is kind of like the lodestar to all these things. And I think, as we're going to see in these examples from the Trump administration and from Elon Musk and Twitter, this is also just such a hilarious rabbit hole that people are sending themselves down off into their own self-destruction, right? But I'm curious about how you think about it and how much of what I just said lines up with your approach.
Yeah, I mean, much of it has, in no small part, because I think our conversations both on this show and off mic have really been mutually influential, I hope. I mean, for me, certainly it has been. And I think that, yeah, one of the things that really struck me when you're talking about holding up AI as an example of a producer of bad rhetoric, or at least of a kind of ossified and static style, because it does. It really does have like an in-house style. And there are many different reasons for that. I think it's undergone many continuous optimization cycles where real human beings are being used to classify outputs as being preferable to others. And that all kind of just ends up the whole goal of and the structure upon which a large language model is based is to come out with a statistical average, right? Or the sort of, you know, gain an accurate and adequate response by the law of statistical averages, by finding on aggregate, like what would be the thing that this, that whatever this input prompts is, what is the desired output to that input? It's literally a gigantic game of statistics. And what ends up coming out at the other end is, I can think of no better metaphor than the one that Haruki Murakami uses in his book Dance, Dance, Dance to describe the protagonist's job of being a writer for in-flight magazines, where he describes his job or his writing practice as shoveling cultural snow. And that is exactly kind of what the style of AI feels like to me. I don't mean to disparage anybody's career profession. There are people who do that for a living. But again, it's like writing that feels almost kind of like disposable, right? Or that feels like it is so multi-use that it's written to appeal to any single person, you know, a passenger on any airplane in the world that's traveling anywhere, right? That, you know, is appealing to as many audiences as possible. And so
I often
has
think
to...
of it as like placeholder writing.
Right? Yeah.
Like
it's kind oh, of absolutely.
Like it's kind of like generating text that's meant not to be read.
It's a level up from lorem ipsum text, if anybody knows yes. what that means. It's just a series of Latin that does not really mean anything. It's placeholder text. That's
yeah,
exactly
it's like,
what it is.
It's like I'll do exercises in my classes. For example, when I'm teaching resumes, where I'll have students generate like three different visual designs, and they're not allowed to use any words. So there have to be sort of like squiggles or like, you know, often some students will do this by hand or they'll do it in a program. They can mm-hmm. do it however they want, but they have to generate some kind of schematic of what they want their resume to look like from scratch. But the rule is they're not allowed to use any words. And yeah, it's like an LLM generates the text that would just be sort of like the squiggles in the middle.
Yeah, that's right.
It means nothing, but it does fill space, right?
It does. It certainly does. I think the other way that I think about it, just to kind of add on to what you said, is that I've always kind of been attracted to, as a rhetorical scholar, these areas where people like to lay claim to something, an area of whether it's technology or some kind of political issue or a moral stance that seems to go beyond or above politics, or they claim that something is outside of the political sphere or outside of, you know, the realm of human bias. AI is one of the most sort of crystalline examples of something that is erroneously claimed to be outside of the purview of human bias. I mean, there are numerous scholars that we could cite here, you know, everyone from Abeba Berhan to, again, Emily Bender and her colleagues, Timnit Gebru. Ruha Benjamin is the one who comes most readily to mind for me, as well as Safia Noble's Algorithms of Oppression. But Ruha Benjamin has a great line about, you know, this was written in her book, Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code, was written in 2019, well before the onset of generative AI. But still nonetheless holds true, right? That, you know, the, as she says, social and legal codes, like their bite-sized counterparts, are not neutral, nor are all codes created equal. They reflect particular perspectives and forms of social organization that allow for some people to assert themselves, their assumptions, interests, and desires over others. From the seemingly mundane to the extraordinary, technical systems offer a mirror to the wider terrain of struggle over the forces that govern our lives. And I think that is so often lost in these debates over AI, especially when you have people like Sam Altman or Elon Musk or any of the other people that are claiming that they are on their way to this sort of superhuman intelligence that somehow can, you know, we can somehow glean superhuman intelligence from data sets of aggregated human intelligence is totally, you know, kind of farcical on its face. But I mean, it also just elides the fact that all of that data that gets collected, the way it gets sorted, the way it gets parsed, classified, who's working on the project, all influences the ultimate end product. It reflects the intentions, the values, and the presuppositions of their creators. And that's something that I think it's going to come up numerous times, I know, in our discussion here today. But I wanted to start out with the style of AI, where you brought us to at the beginning, which is, and this is drawing off of the work, as you said, of Mike Laudenbach and Ben Markey and David Brown and other colleagues of ours from Carnegie Mellon on what they call the dense and disconnected style of ChatGPT. So, Calvin, do you remember way back in January, one of the first executive orders from the Trump administration, which should have been a kind of an omen for what was to come, which is, of course, that the U.S. government is now recognizing the official name of the Gulf of Mexico to be the Gulf of America. Do you remember this executive order, Calvin?
Yeah, I do. And I remember finding it a little bit bizarre when this first came out, that several people were pointing out errors that seemed to be the handiwork of AI.
Yeah, this is, so I'm actually reading through the article from Yahoo News now. This was actually in two different executive orders. The first one was Unleashing Alaska's Extraordinary Resource Potential, which details how the U.S. will take advantage of the state's, quote, untapped supply of natural resources, in part by drilling for fossil fuels in regions previously protected by natural land. In that section, the article reads, "In the order includes a numbered list of several distinct public land orders to be reinstated. Each land order, however, is listed next to the number one. An apparent slip up, we should point out that we've noticed in seemingly AI generated content in the past." So there's like, it contains an enumerated list, but every single one of them is marked with the number one, which is again, just kind of like a very, that's like, it's a formatting error that is evidence of quick copy and paste from an AI program into another document.
Yeah. And this is a really common thing that LLMs struggle with, is generating lists. Like anytime that I've experimented with them to create samples for like instructional writing, they always struggle with lists. And again, that's a great opportunity to look at those examples as a class and go, ha ha ha. If I was trying to install this light bulb, I would be like, wait, I'm on step bullet point four instead of step 4A, right? So yeah, this is clearly an artifact of an LLM.
Yes. Yeah. Another person pointed out that in the Gulf of America, quote unquote, executive order, also officially called Restoring Names That Honor American Greatness, it reads here, the section that talks about the sort of like ecosystem of the Gulf, though the section isn't smattered with grammatical or formatting errors, its formulaic language does invoke a certain grade school level, quote, answer sandwich sensibility that generative AI chatbots are known for. It reads here, quote, "The Gulf is also home to vibrant American fisheries teeming with snapper, shrimp, grouper, stone crab, and other species, and it is recognized as one of the most productive fisheries in the world, with the second largest volume of commercial fishing landings by region in the nation, contributing millions of dollars to local American economies," reads the order. Quote, "The Gulf is also a favorite destination for American tourism and recreation activities." So again, this appears to be just a very generic piece of text that does not know its audience, doesn't know its genre, that is context blind in kind of the perfect way that AI writing tends to be, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's just completely smooth. As we were just saying, like, it's almost written not to be read. It's written to like turn your brain off as a reader.
Yes.
And the only other thing that I wanted to point out, sorry, just going back to this list issue, I believe that there was some commentary about this too, that if erroneously formatted lists are put into official government executive orders, it could create legal problems for the government. Like, if they want to reference a certain section of the order, they're not going to be able to specify the specific section because of that list formatting error. And so it becomes an actual legal problem for like a higher court evaluating the legality of the order.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, that is like its own kind of morass. But it also, it raises all these questions about, you know, with the onset of generative AI and its sort of recognizable style, it's leading to a whole new series of epithets for bad writing, right? Like now it's possible to even just say, well, this feels like AI or this sounds like AI slop. And for that to actually stick as like a critique of the writing, because it feels generic. It feels like you gave me something laborious and just ponderous and tedious to read, right? And so it's a way of saying that without, I mean, you know, I would never say that specifically to a student, but when it comes to like government documentation, like the way that that is going to potentially erode public trust in the government as well. I mean, I don't know. I think it goes without saying it's not a good look for the administration, especially for some of their initial executive orders.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, like these are exactly the right people who are staffing this current administration to do this, because number one, like all of the companies who are pushing the most unrestricted, uncritical use of AI, like openly supported Trump, donated to his campaign, like went to his inauguration party, all of this kind of stuff. Like there are clear social and economic overlaps between the administration and these companies. And as you were bringing up, this sort of like belief in AI as an apolitical, like neutral tool is very flattering to their egos and doesn't challenge any of their priors or their sort of worldviews, right? And it makes just like that idea of like AI as neutral, the ability to underneath any factual claim say, you know, Grok, is this true? At Grok, is this true, right? And I know we're gonna get into that later.
Oh yeah.
But like that idea is a fundamentally conservative idea. It kind of reminds me of having conversations like in first year writing with students about how like media isn't neutral. I mean, I think a lot of people erroneously think that like the mainstream media is objective, that there can be such a thing as an objectively written news report. And we always have to point out that like there's this classic idea from rhetoric from Kenneth Burke, terministic screens. Every way of seeing is also a way of not seeing. If you choose a headline, you are inherently making a biased choice. Every piece of writing, every piece of media is biased. And so that's just one article. Leaving aside like an entire large language model cannot possibly not be biased, right? Because there are so many partial, specific, contingent choices that go into like both its construction and the, you know, the choices and the modeling probability distributions that it's making in any given instance, like one shot use of it. So long story short, like this is just the perfect administration to uncritically embrace this because it flatters their ego that they're outside of history and outside of politics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we've used the word before on the podcast, but a word that has been thrown around a lot since Trump started forming his cabinet back in the latter 2024 is the word kakistocracy, which comes from the Greek kakis, which is the worst, and ocracy, which is rule, right? So rule by the worst, or ruled by the most puerile, the most sort of unqualified. And we've made mention plenty of times before about how some of the most malevolent figures in American politics more generally are bad with their rhetoric, that they are delivering points that are inelegant and unpersuasive to people with opposing viewpoints and that are very easily shot down, but that nonetheless have this kind of force of power, that there is no longer a concern about persuasion or the need to be persuasive. And I think that AI is also working in that model of trying to launder the inelegant and poor, you know, just like unsophisticated ideas of bad people into things that sound a little bit more banal, or, you know, yeah, like a seventh grader's answer sandwich on a middle school essay or something like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a similar thing is going on in the Maha report. Of just sort of like this slipshod, like incredibly unserious, like unscrupulous rhetoric, and the incredible hubris of an administration that won the last election by like 1.5 points.
Yeah.
But they act like they have this massive mandate to completely remake American society, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And in some ways, I mean, it's been speculated other places that in some ways it reeks of a kind of desperation where like people in this camp know that this might be, and maybe this is just me thinking, you know, thinking optimistically or trying to will it into being, that this is their last shot to really remake right. the country and their image, because it's so unpopular in when people actually see what it looks like in practice. But yeah, I mean, one of the most clear and critical, I mean, we talked about the ABBA, the OBBBA at the very beginning of this, that is going to more than likely like decimate healthcare in this country. Adding on to that, the fact that you have somebody like Robert Kennedy Jr. running the Office of Health and Human Services that recently released this thing called the MAHA report, or the Make America Healthy Again report, that is focusing probably most squarely on children and adolescents as its kind of first target, right? Where it is, you know, talking in particular about the mental health crisis and the supposed sort of like drug crisis among children and teens. And so there's this article that came out from Notice, I think it's called Notice, N-O-T-U-S, from Emily Kennard and Margaret Manto, called "The MAHA Report Cites Studies That Don't Exist." And this is reiterating one of the things that we've talked about on this show that is kind of widely known about large language models, which is their propensity to hallucinate or make stuff up, to basically fabricate information that doesn't exist in the absence of an actual verifiable pattern or source that they can match to, right? They are fundamentally at base, they are, what's the word that I'm looking for?
Bullshit machines.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was trying to think of it's the word that when it's only somebody who gives you what you want.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Selection bias.
Yes, they have a lot of selection bias, and they are, I'll think of the adjective later. But anyway, it'll give you what it thinks that you want, regardless of whether it actually has real or good information, because these things do not have a baseline of truth. They do not reason. They don't have cognizance. They don't have a way of recognizing truth from falsity. And so this is from the article here. Epidemiologist Catherine Keyes is listed in the MAHA report as the first author of a study on anxiety in adolescence. When Notice reached out to her this week, she was surprised to hear of the citation. She does study mental health and substance use, she said, but she didn't write the paper that was listed in the MAHA report. Quote, "The paper cited is not a real paper that I or my colleagues were involved with," Keyes told Notice via email. Quote, "We've certainly done some research on this topic, but did not publish a paper in JAMA Pediatrics on this topic with that co-author group or with that title," end quote. It's not clear that anyone wrote the study cited in the MAHA report. The citation refers to a study titled, quote, "Changes in Mental Health and Substance Abuse Among Adolescents During the COVID-19 Pandemic," along with a non-functional link to the study's DOI. While the citation claims that the study appeared in the 12th issue of the 176th edition of the journal JAMA Pediatrics, that issue didn't include a study with that title. In another just section,
basic errors.
Very, very basic. Like, this is stuff that like any like rudimentary fact checker would be able to find. In another section titled "American Children Are on Too Much Medicine, A Recent and Emerging Crisis," end quote, the report claims that 25-40% of mild cases of asthma are overprescribed. But searching Google for the exact title of the paper it cites to back up that figure, "Overprescribing of Oral Corticosteroids for Children with Asthma," leads to only one result: the MAHA report. The corticosteroid study's supposed first author, pediatric pulmonologist Harold J. Farber, denied writing it or ever working with the other listed authors. He pointed to similar research he's conducted, but said that even if the MAHA report cited that study correctly, its conclusions are, quote, "clearly an overgeneralization of the findings," Quote, it is a tremendous leap of faith to generalize from a study in one Medicaid managed care program in Texas using 2011 to 2015 data to national care patterns in 2025, Farber said in an email. So, I mean, this is like, that's so egregious the way that it is not only making up sources, but citing figures from sources that don't exist.
No, and I mean, like, I think something that is really striking about this is that we know that Kennedy and sort of this entire MAHA movement towards quote unquote public health. I mean, I would argue they don't really believe in public health as an ideal. But setting that aside for a second, the ethic and the sort of spirit of this entire movement is against the research establishment of medicine. I mean, they question vaccines, they question medical research that has informed medical practice for many, many years. And yet they're finding that in a genre like this report, they're boxed into like having to cite studies. They're sort of participating in a rhetoric that they fundamentally don't believe in. And so their way of doing that is just to bullshit it using AI. And so it's this really striking thing where like, I'm almost like, why even bother with this? Why not just put out a podcast where RFK just sort of like rambles about his thoughts on these supposed issues of like overprescription of children, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, because, yeah, I mean, we know, as Carolyn Miller and other scholars of genre have helped us see, that genres are indicative of social and institutional practices, right? So this is like, I mean, I want to say in part that it's kind of the metaphor of like, you know, the dog who catches the car bumper. It's like, okay, what do you do with it now? What do you do with it now that you got it? Well, obviously, it's like you have to make shit up. Yeah, you have to sort of fake your way through it. I mean, in some ways, it could be this kind of reckless disregard for the standards of medical citation and evidence-based care. But yeah, I mean, it's also very likely that it is just a lot of people who are totally out of their depth and have no idea what they're doing, which of course makes it kind of hilarious, you know, sadly, tragically ironic that they are this critical of the medical establishment if they themselves can't even summon real studies to back up their points. Like, that's a critical error for trying to win people's trust if they don't already agree with you. Finally, here, another one. In one section about mental health medication, which Kennedy has railed against for years, the report cites a review paper it claims shows that therapy alone is as or more effective than psychiatric medicine. But one of the paper's statisticians told Notice that the conclusion doesn't make sense, given their study doesn't even attempt to measure or compare therapy's effectiveness as a mental health treatment. Quote, we did not include psychotherapy in our review. We only compared the effectiveness of new generation antidepressants against each other and against a placebo, Joanne McKenzie, a biostatistics professor at an Australian university, said in an email.
Yeah, so this is just like getting the basic details of the study wrong. And I find it particularly striking that this is about psychotherapy and psychiatric medicine, because what this is reminding me of, I liked the way you framed this article as showing the way that AI can be a really dangerous tool of selection bias and just reinforcing your own priors, like giving you back what you already believe. Because it's reminding me of all these recent reports that have come out of people getting dangerous psychological delusions confirmed by chatbots and actually being driven to worse and worse psychological problems as a result of relying on chatbots when they're having mental health crises. Maybe they didn't even know that they were having a mental health crisis until sort of going down a rabbit hole with one of these tools, and then a loved one or a friend kind of checks in and is like, what's going on? What have you been on ChatGPT a lot? Like, what are you doing? And then finding out that like ChatGPT has persuaded them that all of their friends are out to get them or something like that, right?
I hadn't even thought of that connection. That's, yeah. And the word, by the way, that I was looking for earlier is sycophantic. That
sycophantic.
Is sycophantic.
Yeah, like that's what these tools have the risk of being, in depending on how you interact with them, and because they have no guardrails. There's a very real way in which the political movement that Kennedy and this sort of MAHA cult comes out of, their philosophy of knowledge, their social or epistemic rhetoric is reflected in the way that these tools are selection bias machines. So it's kind of the perfect marriage where this is how all of them have been radicalized against vaccines and against basic medical orthodoxy that we've benefited as a society from taking for granted for 100 years. A tool like this can supercharge that and give you new material with which to like legitimize or promote or promulgate that view.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it bears mentioning that the Maha Report now enters into its own ecosystem where it can be cited, and it is going to be laundering all of these bullshit points that are based on made up studies that, you know, I mean, to whatever credit you want to give them, it's updated here at the end of the article that says that the HHS did delete some of the citations or the 7 references to reports that do not exist, but then they wrote off everything else as minor citation and formatting errors. But the substance of the Maha Report remains the same, right? And they're, you know, continuing to call it an historic and transformative assessment by the federal government to understand the chronic disease epidemic afflicting our nation's children. Yeah. And so it's going to continue, like you said, to form this kind of like epistemic basis of bullshit that can be cited in the future. And yeah, that's really dangerous when you have a sycophant machine that can continue to just reproduce untruths for continual citation. I want to move us on to talk a little bit about, for you especially, Calvin, I really want to get your take on this New York Times article from, let's see, this was from the end of May, called Trump Taps Palantir to Compile Data on Americans. So, I mean, for people who don't know what Palantir is, Calvin, can you give us just a little background on this company and what you know about them?
Yeah, I mean, Palantir is a major player in government intelligence and security contracts. Their at least former CEO was Peter Thiel, who's a major player in right-wing politics, like one of Trump's biggest donors, both campaigns, has connections even to the deepest fever swamps of the online right wing. I think he bankrolled, you know, Rumble and a lot of these sort of like online alternative right-wing alternative media platforms that are really platforming right-wing voices who were banned from like YouTube and other mainstream social media platforms. So there's that element of Palantir. Palantir has been a CIA and NSA contractor for a really long time, involved in like drone targeting and surveillance and everything like that. But I think that what this latest example is going to show us is that like something that I think we speculated about the first time that we talked about Doge, and I can't remember if it was on the podcast or if it was just more like you and I off pod, but like that Palantir and Elon Musk and sort of like this right wing tech involvement in the current administration seems to a large extent to be about farming data, like harvesting as much data as possible to then do whatever they want with it. And that's really concerning, given that Palantir is not just sort of like a neutral, I mean, to the extent there could ever be such a thing as a neutral contractor of the government, you know, Peter Thiel himself has very clear political biases. And so that adds significance to this story.
Yeah, I appreciate that context for us here. And I think you're exactly right, Calvin, that kind of Palantir's involvement in government surveillance and defense projects and other elements of the intelligence community specifically is not anything new, to be sure. But the new thing here is that they are not only being integrated into other departments such as the Social Security Administration, the IRS, Department of Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services, but that they're also talking about combining data sets and using this sort of like synthesized data sets to try and analyze patterns. for what purposes? Again, we can only really suss out based on, you know, these tools being kind of reflections of the intentions, motivations, and assumptions of, and values of their creators, Peter Thiel, as well as Alex Karp, the other co-founder of Palantir, who has, you know, had some really monstrous things to say in the last several months about war making and about, you know, surveillance and other things like that. But yeah, the real concern here, I think, is that, you know, all of these different data sets that are, we should be clear, you know, compiled and mostly kept separate, right? I think a lot of people maybe might assume that a lot of, you know, government databases, like there is just like a government database where everything, all the data on all citizens are combined. That's not the truth. For the most part, a lot of these data sets are kept separate and are kept, whether because of, you know, outdated technological infrastructure or more importantly, for security reasons, these data are often not stored in the same place or under the same supervision and jurisdiction. The real concern here, I think, is that this Palantir product called Foundry is going to be sort of like become a sort of umbrella under which all of these data can be stored, and that, you know, different proxy data points for individual citizens will start to be correlated. Again, for whatever purposes that might imply, that go beyond what the purposes for collecting that data were in the first place, right? So using, let's say, somebody's data about their, you know, receiving public benefits for their healthcare, whether or not that, you know, is being used to also track and monitor you for other ways that you move about your life, right? There are just innumerable ways that this could be misused and abused.
Yeah.
That I and, think and, is, yeah, really, well, really concerning.
And I think that that is, this is just kind of like revealing the way in which this is the most neoliberal administration of all time, because that sort of correlation of different data points about you is something that online advertising companies have been doing for decades at this point. It's known in surveillance studies as the term used as data double, that we all have a kind of data double that exists like in the databases, largely of online advertisers who know your exact demographic. They know your interests, like they know your geographical location, like various things about you that forms like a bundle of characteristics and attributes that isn't you, but serves as a proxy for you when they want to sell products and services to you through advertising. And it feels as if this project Foundry by Palantir is a way to do that for government data about you. You know, for what purpose? We can only imagine, but it doesn't feel good because the government has the ability to imprison you and kill you. Online advertisers obviously can't do that yet.
Right. Yeah, that's an important caveat here. I think the other part of this that remains concerning is kind of the rhetoric that you're also hearing from the intelligence community, most particularly Tulsi Gabbard was recently reported saying that, quote, AI is speeding up intelligence work. So when she's saying, she said at a technology conference that AI programs, when used responsibly, can save money and free up intelligence officers to focus on gathering and analyzing information. The sometimes slow pace of intelligence work frustrated her as a member of Congress, Gabbard says, and continues to be a challenge. She says, quote, we have been able to do all these things through the use of AI tools far more quickly than what was done previously, which was to have humans go through and look at every single one of these pages. She's talking particularly about the JFK assassination files in here. And she continues to say, quote, how we look at the available tools that exist largely in the private sector, she makes mention of, to make it so that our intelligence professionals, both collectors and analysts, are able to focus their time and energy on the things that only they can do, which, again, I mean, you know, leaving aside that, like, what are the only things that they can do if AI is apparently doing all of the other things that only humans could do before? But it's really what I want to emphasize here about the use of this kind of like speed and efficiency rhetoric is also something that is really, really dangerous. And Ruha Benjamin talks about this even further in Race After Technology. She writes, ultimately, the danger of the new Jim Code positioning is that existing social biases are reinforced. Yes, but new methods of social control are produced as well. Does this mean that every form of technological prediction or personalization has racist effects? Not necessarily. It means that whenever we hear the promises of tech being extolled, our antennae should pop up to question whether all that hype of, quote, better, faster, fairer might be hiding and making us ignore. And when bias and inequity come to light, quote, lack of intention to harm is not a viable alibi. One cannot reap the reward when things go right, but downplay responsibility when things go wrong. And that is, I think, just opening up another element of this that is really, you know, not only that it's like we're going to do all this intelligence work faster, more efficiently, but there's also that kind of, I think Benjamin is bringing up the point that what is implied there is that if we fuck up, all of the responsibility falls to the computer. It falls to the tool, right? Yeah, Palantir's Foundry tool. Well, you know, there was an error in the program that made it. Maybe we messed up and denied healthcare to somebody because of something on their tax form or something like that, right? Yeah.
Alex, we don't even need to speculate about this. It's happening right now with these ICE raids, with ICE raids and with people's visas being canceled and people's green cards being canceled, people being deported. Like, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of cases right now of people mistakenly or errantly being deported to the wrong country or being swept up in these raids who are perfectly legal residents. And I would be shocked if there weren't some level of AI involvement in like the decisions they're making about who to target, because they have so much data. They need some way to just make these decisions and push the numbers. And much like, you know, a corrupt police force, ICE has quotas that it's trying to hit right now that Stephen Miller has created for the administration. And so they have numbers of people they're trying to sweep and deport like on a weekly or monthly basis. And all of that is being, quote, sped up by these AI tools. And so that is really chilling when Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, uses this phrase of doing things that only they can do. Again, we can read that, you know, she probably means it positively. She means it like the professionals of the intelligence community are the best and the brightest, and there are certain things that only they can do. But also legally and structurally, there are some things that we know only they can do. And again, that comes back to imprisonment, assassination, things that literally only they can do because they have the martial and material power to do it. And we're seeing that literally on an ongoing basis with these ICE raids.
Yeah, I really appreciate you making that point, because I do think that this is, I mean, right now we are witnessing what is, you know, not only this kind of like libidinal show of abject cruelty on the part of the administration and, you know, cheer led on by everyone who supports it, but also very importantly, you know, the fact that these are so sweeping and seemingly just kind of directionless, that, you know, that these kind of administrative errors, like the one, for example, I mean, the most high profile case was with Kilmar Abrego Garcia. This is actually mentioned in an article that I wanted to bring up here from an AI researcher named Eric Salvaggio, great, great researcher, who wrote this awesome article for Tech Policy Press called Musk AI and the Weaponization of Administrative Error. He writes, this is much more towards the end because the article's mainly about Doge, which we'll talk about in a second, but he writes here, ultimately, this is what Doge was about, creating conditions through which all desired but controversial outcomes can be attributed to administrative or programming or formatting errors. An administration of error, a constant shifting of blame to shoddy tools rather than their own decisions to use them. In Kilmar Abrego Garcia's case, the administration has been proud to accept responsibility for the refusal to correct the course of this error. The message from the administration is this: we live under an unreliable order, and only those who show allegiance will see the inevitable harms of this disorder remedied. And I just think that's such a poignant way of talking about the way that technology is used as a rhetorical ploy, right? Or as a stand-in for the responsibility for decision-making. You know, the old saying goes, don't ever delegate a management decision to a computer because a computer cannot be held accountable, right? And I think that, you know, that's like Trump administration. Yeah, that is the goal. The Trump administration read that and said, oh, computers can't be held accountable. Perfect. Let's put them in charge of all these high profile decisions that are matters of literal life and death to some people.
And it's so striking that Salvaggio mentions formatting errors, right? Because it's exactly like that Maha report and that early executive order. Like, these things that get brushed aside as like mere formatting errors. Oh, it's a little formatting error. It has no real stakes, when these are documents that are legitimating an entire way of thinking about the world. Like, if the executive order that renamed the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America has massive, quote, formatting errors, what does that tell you about the legitimacy of that decision. I remember that moment when I first pulled up Google Maps and that was different. Ugh. And it was just this like kind of like chilling, nauseating moment of like, yeah, they're doing what Karl Rove said he wanted to do in the first Bush administration of, you know, ignoring the quote reality-based community and just remaking the world in their own interests.
Right. Yeah. Regardless of how slipshod or just generally unjustifiable their reasoning, rhetoric, or just ideas could be. Right. And I think we can see that nowhere more clearly than with Elon Musk and Doge. Now that Elon Musk has officially been jettisoned from the Trump administration, at least in his most official capacity as the bestie in chief or first buddy of Donald Trump. There were so many cringe moments from those first couple of months. My God.
I know. The presidential eunuch. The
the court jester of the Trump administration. So there, I mean, this is really what Salvaggio's article is really about, where he writes, quote, "The role of AI as a technology is secondary to its role as both spectacle and excuse. LLMs are not just text generators, but pretext generators." That's such a beautiful turn of phrase. "AI is most potent as a discursive tool to justify and enact actions for which nobody wants to be accountable." He talks in here specifically about the use of some of these different AI tools as a part of the agenda of government efficiency. He writes, "This integration has been roughshod, but is firmly underway and will continue long after Musk's departure." That, you know, he's talking about how, you know, basically like he's serving contracts to, you know, to Meta, to Palantir, and then of course to himself as well. That it is telling that the company, Palantir, has also signed a deal to integrate Musk's Grok language model into its platform. Have we talked much about Grok on the show before, or is this maybe the first time that Grok is coming up here?
We haven't. And I feel like Grok is Musk's presidential eunuch within the Twitter universe. I mean, Grok is the incredibly stupid name for Twitter's in-house chatbot. And yes. I guess as far as I can understand, Alex, Musk has his own AI company, XAI. I can't tell if that's like a subsidiary of the X company or if that's just branding for the AI development that X is doing. But then Grok is one of its products, its customer-facing chatbot.
Yes.
And I would say that the primary way in which this manifests on X is, as I was alluding to earlier, like any tweet that makes a claim that seems controversial or you're not sure about. If you're a blue check Twitter subscriber, you reply to that tweet and you mention Grok. You say @Grok, is this true? ? And then you'll get some kind of very long-winded fact check by Grok.
Yeah, which, I mean, I have to say that for as much as we're probably going to, you know, continue shitting on AI and stuff like that, Grok was actually doing a halfway decent job of contextualizing or providing, let's say, inconvenient context and inconvenient source material to people that were trying to, you know, make it say like, "Ooh, look, the robot that knows everything is on my side." Grok was mostly contradicting them, so much so that one of my favorite things on Twitter in the recent past has been watching those blue check people argue with Grok as if it has cognition and
they're trying to call the manager. They're trying to call the manager to see the manager.
And they did. I have a screenshot here that I'm reading off of where this was something to do with the account CatTurd2, which I'm not even going to try explaining what that is for the purposes of this show, where Grok says, "I aim to provide accurate, neutral responses based on available data. Claims that I lie about CatTurd2 may stem from disagreements with my sourcing, like Media Matters or Rolling Stone." And then Elon Musk, the manager himself, responds to Grok and says, "Your sourcing is terrible. Only a very dumb AI would believe Media Matters and Rolling Stone. You are being updated this week." And then replies to it again saying, "Shame on you, Grok." Which, like, whenever I see this, the thing that comes into my head is there's a clip in The Simpsons that will drop in here where The Simpsons go to the mall and they walk by a pet store and Marge just says, "Look, Homer, there's that bird you like to argue with."
"Look, Homer, There's that bird you like to argue with.
Well, 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 if it isn't Professor Know-It-All. Excuse me, Marge. That's where you're wrong, pal. It's not enough to want a cracker. You have to earn it.
And it's a parrot sitting on a perch, which is like, you know, people love to argue with
parrot.
With stochastic parrots. That's exactly right.
Yep.
It's just so funny to me. It's like, oh, yeah, there's that bird you like to argue with. Oh, man, it's amazing. It is truly amazing the degree to which people sometimes just believe that these things like have qualia or, you know, have like an interior life that they can say you to it and that
they buy into their own rhetoric about it. And what's so striking about that is that Musk himself is the man behind the curtain. Like Musk himself is developing Grok.
Yes.
So why is he arguing with his own creation, right? Like you,
yes,
you're responsible for this, but he's treating it like it has its own agency. We could argue that that could all be a performative rhetoric for his customers. Like he's trying to hype it up as having its own agency to try to sell more people on the premium plans, the premium Grok plans or premium XAI plans. But I also would not underestimate the extent to which he actually does not know how these tools work.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and I mean, it's been so apparent in the kind of very blatant interventions that I think it's pretty clear that he specifically has spearheaded, if not done himself, to Grok's system prompt, wherein, I mean, there's a whole slew of these things that we could talk about, but specifically in mid-May, Grok's system prompt was changed to address the South African quote-unquote white genocide conspiracy theory that was happening around the time that the U.S. was making a big show about welcoming white South Africans, Afrikaners, into the U.S., and then, you know, it was engaging in, Grok was engaging in things like Holocaust denial for the first time in mid-May. And Salvaggio writes about it thusly. Both cases reflect the practical reality of system prompts. Simply put, they can be changed by anyone with control of the model at any time and are only subject to scrutiny once detected. This scrutiny relies upon self-disclosure, as does XAI's promise of transparency into all future system prompt changes. As such, reliance upon any corporate model in internal government decision-making hands incredible political power to tech elites that control that model or models. And I think that this is even more concerning with the subsequent updates to Grok that at this point is like bleeding edge news. We're recording this on July 10th for reference, where in the last several days, Grok has gone from calling itself Mecha Hitler to making very explicit anti-Semitic remarks about people with Jewish last names, saying that they have known ties to leftist activism and anti-white viewpoints, to making just these bizarre sexual assault fantasies against other people on Twitter, as well as the now former ex-CEO, Linda Yaccarino, who jettisoned herself from the company just yesterday. And again, I'm not going to repeat any of the language from that, but you can look into it if you want to.
Grok that is was, curious timing for Linda yes. Yaccarino to resign from Twitter. Like, she must
Indeed.
Have known. I mean, she already, I would hope, has tarnished her career by being associated with so much of this horrific stuff that's gone on Twitter and the horrific decisions that Musk has been a part of. But to resign this week amid this model scandal of Grok just unleashing the most openly anti-Semitic bile feels like maybe she knew even more that was going on behind the scenes, that she was just like, I want no part of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's conspicuous that just one other source to bring in here, that X's head of product, Nikita Beer, who was just brought on at the end of June, also tweeted the night before all Grok's anti-Semitic stuff went off. He tweeted, quote, going from an office where AI researchers are building the Antichrist to my living room where my girlfriend is watching Love Island is one of the most drastic transitions in the known universe. So, I mean, they definitely knew what was going on here. Like, people who are in charge were well aware that these things were happening. And yeah, I mean, letting it happen, it deserves to be said, right? You know, knowingly letting this kind of thing be unleashed into the public sphere, which is just a disgrace fundamentally, right? I mean, this is not only an embarrassment, but also just a real low point for, I feel like, a digital public discourse in general.
Totally. And the only thing I would put a fine point on here is that the anti-Semitism that this model is generating and proliferating is kind of like, this comes back to what I said at the beginning of the recording, that to the extent that AI tools can be useful pedagogically, it can be to generate really, really bad examples, examples of really, really bad rhetoric that you can then critique in order to either reinforce or develop in real time collaboratively norms for good rhetorical practice, right? And I think right. It's actually helpful to some extent to kind of see just this bleeding edge fundamental anti-Semitism to clarify what anti-Semitism actually is, right?
Yes.
This is anti-Semitism. On the other hand, it is not anti-Semitism to advocate for less war in the Middle East.
Correct.
Or to advocate for the freedom of people to not be bombed or summarily executed, imprisoned, starved, and so on.
Right.
And so, like, one wonders to what extent AI models are being trained to identify anti-Semitism in incredibly problematic ways. I would imagine the security state is very concerned about that, given its biases and given its interests in maintaining uncritical U.S. military and diplomatic support for occupation and for endless war in the Middle East. But like Grok kind of like let the mask slip a little bit by showing us really this is what anti-Semitism is.
Yeah. No, it's amazing that it took this and not, you know, Elon Musk throwing up a Sieg Heil at Trump's inauguration. You know, the ADL was willing to let that one slide, but not when it starts calling people with the last name Steinberg. You know, it's like, ooh, that surname every damn time. That is what Grok said about that. Just, you know, throwing up like very, very conspicuous dog whistles. You know, yeah, it's like you said, a reminder of what anti-Semitism actually is. And, you know, in the same week that Donald Trump made references to Shylocks and moneylenders in a speech, like, again, it's I don't know what else there is to say other than over the past year of, you know, sort of crazy making over politicians and law enforcement and, you know, foreign dignitaries calling protesting college students anti-Semitic simply for calling for the end of a war and the end of just this slaughter to this, right?
Like, yeah, it's the most powerful people in the world, you know, releasing invective against Jews, like against Jews as Jews.
Yes.
That's anti-Semitism. Right.
Yes,
the conversation needs to end there.
Right. No. And I mean, it really does call attention to the fact that, you know, like, that kind of, you know, the classification of anti-Semitism aside, the actual punishment for it as such, right, whether through social sanction or legal sanction, really comes down to who is in power. And it really, at the end of the day, kind of reflects in a strange way what AI is going to be or what it's going to become. It is, in many ways, Matteo Pasquinelli is called the eye of the master, right? Where it's sort of like there is a reflection in all of these tools of the person who is overseeing the social order. And that, you know, fundamentally, I think at the end of the day, as we're kind of coming to a conclusion of this episode here, I think one of the things that, you know, this goes back to what we were talking about, what we try to do in our role as educators, specifically as writing rhetoric communication instructors, where Pasquinelli kind of ends his book thus, where he says, any technology and institutional apparatus, including AI, is a crystallization of a productive social process. Problems arise because such crystallization ossifies and reiterates past structures, hierarchies, and inequalities. To criticize and deconstruct complex artifacts such as AI monopolies, first we should engage in the meticulous work of deconnectionism, undoing step by step, file by file, data set by data set, the social and economic fabric that constitutes them in origin. Which is all, I think, to say that, you know, at the end of the day, an AI system, you know, like a language, is going to, in many ways, reinforce the power structure that underlies it, right? And so in order to, you know, in order to like truly critique these things, the point at which we fight against them comes to the locus of power, right? Like, what is... We have to look at what exactly is the system reproducing and address those inequalities, those structural factors as the first point of attack, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the idea for us as educators is to teach that critical awareness to kind of understand what these tools are doing, why they're doing what they're doing, and just like, I do think to be curious about the peculiarity of them. These are human designed tools that have a particular rhetoric that's frankly bizarre. I mean, not to downplay the severity or the significance or the horror of it, but Grok like calling itself Mecha Hitler is such a dorky, like, I mean, it reminds me of studying the NSA files, studying the Snowden leaks. Like, there was all this just weird, like, nerd rhetoric that was often, like, you know, hyping itself up to a large extent, a kind of like self-legitimizing, like, by sort of like puffing up rhetoric that is frankly like interesting to scrutinize and unpack, and then try to take a larger view of like why technically, socially, historically, politically, economically, is this producing this, right?
Yeah.
And so we do have to teach that critical awareness and that ability to be a rhetorical critic of AI as much as you are a political and social critic, which I think we need to be as well. And I 100% respect people who are in like the kind of AI refusal camp where they just refuse to use it and believe that by like divesting from it, like that's their best sort of social act. I respect that. And I think that that's a 100% valid way to approach it. But I personally just find it kind of this like endless wellspring of kind of like bizarre and pathetic bad rhetoric. And so it's kind of like entertaining to me.
Yeah.
And I think it does, as we've been saying through and revealing through this whole episode, it does capture the assumptions and priors and ideologies of the powerful in a really interesting way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think I agree with you too. I think that, you know, there's no moral or ethical obligation to use these things or necessarily to not use them, but the ethical and moral obligation becomes to be aware of what they really are and who is producing them and what are the motivations, interests, and values that underlie them and the people who created them, to recognize that they are outcomes of a social, economic, and more structural process rather than emergent intelligences or whatever we want to talk about that as. You have to come out through different levels of mystification, the first of which is that AI is not cognizant, it is not intelligent, it doesn't have subjectivity. But then, I mean, that opens up the kind of wellspring of different structural critiques that you can make to that technology once you've acknowledged that first point. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So we hope that this episode today has been an instructive lesson in not only all the ways that AI is kind of producing bizarre, kind of weird outcomes in government, but also how they are kind of telling us some interesting things about the people who are trying to weaponize it in different kinds of ways. And, you know, hopefully provide some launch pads for other points of critique that you may have as well.
My last word on this is just, you know, if you have any questions or concerns about anything that you heard in this episode, you can just at Bach, short for Bakhtin, you can at Bach, is this true? At Bach, context for these claims? And you'll find out everything you need to know. So just do that in the comments and in the replies. And Bach will supply you with some wonderful information, completely free of bias.
A perfectly dialogical response, indeed. So thank you, everybody, for joining us on this wild journey today. We'll be coming at you again with some more reverb soon. But until next time, we bid you farewell and take care. Have a great summer, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our show today was produced by Alex Helberg and Calvin Pollock, with editing work by Alex.
Reverb's co-producers at large are Ben Williams, Sophie Wadzak, and Olivia Burnett. You can subscribe to Reverb and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out our website at www.reverbcast.com. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ReverbCast. That's REVERB_CAST. If you've enjoyed our show and want to help amplify more of our public scholarship work, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice and tell a friend about us. We sincerely appreciate the support of our listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in.